Hey everybody, it's Chris Aiken from Aftershocks reminding you that if you want to see the interviews, see the artists, and see Matt and I ramble on with the artists, subscribe to us on YouTube. Just go to the link bit.ly/AftershocksPod1, the number one. So bit.ly/AftershocksPod1. And you can subscribe and see all of our videos in this video cast.
Aaron, here you are, the curator of the long distance connection, and you get it wrong.
I get it wrong. I'm fucking up. It's fine.
All right. Well, where's our good friend Scott?
Right here.
Oh, hey, there he is. There's Scott. Well, welcome back, Scott. How are you?
Hey, hold on. I got to turn off the show.
You and me both. They were playing good music anyway.
I know, I hear it.
All right, now sorry about that.
Are you digging the show, Scott?
Yeah, sounds good. Was that New Armored Saint you played?
No, that's two records back, or yeah, one record.
Oh, okay. One record
back, yeah. But they do have a new one out, by the way.
Yeah, they have that documentary out that I saw a trailer or two for.
Yeah, they have a new one called Punching the Sky,
which is really kick ass. Yeah, definitely recommended.
I don't think Armored Saint has ever put out a bad record.
Nah, probably not. I mean, Retribution or whatever? Revelation.
Yeah.
That one wasn't so great. Obviously, we don't even know the name of it. So that one wasn't so great. But yeah, I mean, for the most part, they're Armored Saint. They're always pretty good.
Yeah, they're kind of like AC/DC. You know what you're going to get.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, the new AC/DC. I'll tell you what album I really love is the new Fates Warning. And they're always been a favorite band of mine from the back in the day.
Yeah, 10 songs, an hour and a half. Can't go wrong with that.
Well, I think they've aged a lot better than Queensryche and Dream Theater, honestly.
There's two dudes left in Queensryche.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep, yep.
All right, Scott. Well, Chris had pointed out something to me this week. This whole fraudulent election has been a wild ride. And supposedly a mob boss in Philadelphia is allegedly flipping on the Biden campaign, saying that he falsified what, 300,000 votes for $10 a pop.
Right.
You know, again, you never know what you can believe, what not to believe these days. I mean, there is no credibility in journalism these days, and it's hard to know if any of these things are true, or if people are just looking for publicity, or what's going on. So we thought we'd bring you on to see what you know, or if you've heard this, or if you have heard it, if there's any credibility or truth to any of it.
Yeah, I heard it was making the rounds on the mafia forums. In short, it's BS. So a few things about it. It's a well put together theory, but doesn't really hold up. In fact, first of all, Merlino doesn't live in Philly anymore. He lives in Florida.
Okay.
He's been on supervised release for the past year. He had pled out. It's maybe about 2.5 years ago. He had pled out. He had been a trial. Actually, I attended some of his trial in New York City. And he pled guilty. I think there was like a bookmaking off the top of my head. Anyway, long story short, he got out due to sentencing guidelines about a year ago. He's still on supervised release, but he's in Florida right now. Him and his attorney both made comments saying, we've heard some wild stories about us, but this is definitely no truth to this one. But it's funny that it came out because just yesterday there was a arrest of four Philly wise guys by the FBI. So it's kind of a funny timing. I haven't really heard much out of Philly. Then you get this story, and then these wise guys get busted the other day. So.
What did they get busted for? Was it just for standard crimes, or was it tied to the election?
No, it was bookmaking. And the guy that was arrested, Sonny Mazzone, his older brother was a one-time acting boss. And there's been rumors of a large FBI investigation going on in Philly, stretching back a few years, traditional organized crime stuff.
Sure.
Although it's kind of funny that they're bookmaking, because there's like a, like five or six casinos like within, you know, an hour's drive of Philly, but they're still doing illegal bookmaking and street bookmaking.
Go ahead, Neely. Go ahead.
I was going to say, yeah, because you don't have to leave your home and go to Atlantic City.
Yeah, that's true.
Do you think, Scott, that the reason they stay into bookmaking is because it's one of those that is a largely unreported crime? You know, anybody that would go to a less than reputable bookie these days knows that they can't really go to the police if they get threatened to get their legs broken or whatever. Because they've committed an illegal act, they know. So it almost makes it an easy win for the mob to kind of stay under the radar and make bank.
Yeah. And even though in New Jersey now sports betting is legal, that neighborhood bookie, you don't have to pay taxes on it. You have to claim the winnings. Sometimes you can get better odds depending on, right, what your bookie is given. So there's a variety of reasons. Now, obviously that stream of revenue has declined over the years, especially now that Jersey, I think last year they overtook Nevada in terms of pure amount of money that was being wagered on sporting events. So, I mean, people love to gamble. It's still big business. And if, if there's still an opportunity or to make money doing it, illegally, sure.
Sure.
Well, Scott, I wanted to ask you, getting back to the whole election fraud stuff. Now, you said that, the story is bogus. It's bullshit. How do stories like this even originate? I mean, where do you think that even started, and how did they get to, cite numbers saying 300,000 votes at $10 a piece and it's attributed to this guy and so on and so forth? Do you know what the genesis of that story is, or where that may have come from, or is it just somebody speculating, or do you even know?
And we lost Scott. There he is.
Oh, there he is. Sorry about that.
Did you hear the question?
No, I didn't. What's the question?
All right. Well, the question was, getting back to the, the election thing. Mm-hmm. Where does a story like this originate? I mean, obviously the story cited some specific things, mentioning 300,000 votes at $10 a piece, and that this mob figure was going to flip on the Biden campaign and admit to it and all that. Where does a story like that even come from? To cite this and say, yeah, this is what this mob guy did, and he's going to do this and that. I mean, where does a story like that even, what is the genesis of a story like that?
So the actual original story came out of this Buffalo newspaper that's been cited as kind of, for lack of a better descriptor, like the Weekly World News. There's a few things. First of all, the guy obviously knows nothing about the publishing industry, because he said Joey Merlino was going to flip for a $10 million advance on a book he was going to write. Yeah, no way, no how he's getting a $10 million advance on a book. That also that he wanted to be a park ranger, so he was hoping that he would get a job with the National Park Service. that was in the article as well. I think because of Pennsylvania, and ironically, Philly wasn't really an area where, there was issues as much of the voting as other parts of Pennsylvania, but I think they saw it as an opportunity to, with all the rigmarole going on with everything related to the election, to put a story out there. But there was one other line that was pretty funny in there. Unnamed sources, of course. There were.
Of course. Well, do you think that there is, and probably on a much smaller level, obviously, but do you think that there is still mob influence with this election, but with other elections as well, even if it's just localized city officials and, governors and mayors and stuff? Do you think that the mob still has their tentacles into that a little bit?
Maybe a little bit, not as much as in the past, but you know, the mob's influence in elections, notwithstanding, you know, the urban legend about Kennedy getting elected, but it has always really been at the local level. It's the exact, like you said, city councilmen, you know, aldermen in Chicago,
right?
Mayors, governors, state representatives, New Jersey, you know, long history of that going on there. You haven't really seen much of that in the last like 15 to 20 years, but it, you know, it's not to say there is not some of that still going on, but absolutely back in the day, it was pretty large.
Do you think it went away in large part because of the Whitey Bulger thing and how public that was, not only of Whitey getting nailed, but because of the officials that went down with him? You know, do you think that kind of ended people's willingness to, you know, deal with the underbosses and the underlings in the mob?
Yeah, that too. And, you know, more transparency, more, you know, more of that stuff's out in the open, you know, back in, you know, say, for example, like the 50s or 60s, you know, they weren't covering. You can get away with a lot more behind closed doors. It's a lot more difficult, and certainly in politics, to do that as much now as it was back then. But no, you bring up a good point about especially the Bulger thing, you know, when that just really embarrassed a lot of people, certainly laid bare the depths of official corruption, you know, into the FBI and other law enforcement. So that really, and in a lot of ways, you see structural kind of changes to the way things are run, that prevent kind of that nefarious influence that they used to have.
Right. Definitely. Go ahead, Neely.
Well, I thought you had another subject you wanted to ask us.
Oh, I definitely do.
I'm done with the, you know, the election thing, you okay. know, because, you know, Philadelphia is no, you know, is no stranger to corruption mm-hmm. and elections and stuff. So obviously, you know, asking Scott to come on and give his insight in this was, you know, one of the main things I was interested in, but I know you were dredging up something additional to ask Scott.
I do. I discovered two new mobsters this week, Scott, and I wanted to get some insight on it because these guys seemed way fucked, way more fucked than most of these mob guys. I'm talking about the Cray twins. Are you familiar with the Cray twins?
Yeah, so Reginald and, oh, who's the other one?
Ronnie.
Ronnie, yeah. The Cray brothers, they were London gangsters in the 60s. In fact, one of them just passed away like a couple of years ago. So they, but they were, they were notorious London mobsters from the stuff that I've read about them in some research, because there was some interactions between them and American mafiosos.
Right.
But they were... they were pretty hardcore, and they were warring with other gangs at the time. Very violent, very violent. I think one of the brothers, most likely, kind of a psychopath.
It's funny. I watched what is a terrible movie called Legend, and it's not the Will Smith.
Yeah,
Legend.
With Tom Hardy. Yeah.
Yeah, it's an awful, awful movie. But it made me interested in these two. And then I went and watched like 15 documentaries on them on YouTube. And I was just like, my God, it's such a bizarre story to watch. You know, I mean, their rise was fairly similar to the rise of everybody in the American mob, you know, one guy gets whacked and then they take over and take the power. But they did. They had the interaction selling Cougar Ants or something for Meyer Lansky was what. I think was how they got in. But the one guy, Ronnie Cray, he was the crazy one. He was openly gay in the 60s, which that all by itself is like, wow, mm-hmm. you know, and then to say that in the mob is even a double wow. I think that was just, you know, you couldn't do that. So, you know, what was it about? Was it just that these guys were so vicious that they were able to rise, you know, in spite of the fact that they were really kind of outside of even what is accepted in the mob? At least the one guy was.
Yeah. And there's a little bit of different rules over there, especially with kind of the endemic English gangs at the time. But, you know, again, you had the ability to have the official corruption going on at that time, but they really rose to the top through violence. And that was a real kind of a tumultuous time in the London underworld. And it's interesting. There's, you know, they were kind of supplanted by more sophisticated English organized crime groups that kind of spread their tentacles around to other parts of Europe. And then most recently, they've been supplanted by other groups like Russians and Eastern European gangs coming into London and England. So, but they were kind of what the American Mafia were in the 20s and 30s and the 60s. Then they were kind of going through those growing pains of
right.
being the more of the gangland skirmishes at the lower level.
Right. And just for, again, from watching the documentaries, what surprised me about these guys, and I don't think I've ever seen anybody do it quite the way they did it. They intermingled themselves as legit business guys more than pretty much anybody in the mafia. They set people up with taking photos with different people and just held on to the photos until they needed them to blackmail people. And, you know, they got various people in the English government to, you know, show up at sex parties at the one guy's house, and then they took pictures of him when he wasn't paying attention and used that as blackmail to get influence. And it really was like crazy how these guys, it wasn't, I guess with most of the other guys, they either just use violence or they kind of sit in the shadows, you know, like a Castellano guy, you know, they more sit in the shadows and let everybody else do the dirty work. These guys were the combination of, they tried to be in the public world, but at the same time, they also were vicious, vicious, vicious guys.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's what led to their downfall. You know, the other thing from, you know, what I've read about the craze too, they never had a real big family. You know, they weren't like the Gambinos, 200 right. or 3, you know, 1,000 guys or whatever. You know, they had a pretty small crew of guys. But, you know, I think the one thing is eventually there was too much violence for, you know, authorities to kind of ignore or turn the blind eye to. And then I think there was a, you know, you talk about the sex parties and the scandals with the British politicians at that time. That was real big.
Right.
Big news.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I know I had never really heard of them. And, you know, of course, the minute I heard of them, I have to know everything that there is about everything. but yeah, I mean, just going through it, they're actually a bigger name than considering I'd never heard of them before today or before this week. You know, they're like big in pop culture too. They're like referenced in like a bunch of songs and movies, and they actually, and maybe it's just because they're more recent. I think the one guy died in 95 and one died in 2000. And then their brother, Charlie Cray, died in 2005. So they were still, maybe that's part of the reason that they've made more pop culture is because they're a more recent, they're probably the most recent active guys since, you know, Gotti, really.
Yeah. 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 They kind of have like that Al Capone, John Gotti, you know, feel to them over in England, or
right.
The right word. But, you know, they're kind of looked at in a similar way from a pop right. culture perspective, I think.
Well, speaking of pop culture, as far as the Cray brothers are concerned, I learned about them back in the 70s when Monty Python's Flying Circus did a spoof on them and they called them the Piranha Brothers. Did you ever see that?
It was
Doug and Dinsdale Piranha, and they spoofed on them, you know, where they were the cruelest, meanest guys on the South End. And, you know, the Pythons made a big joke about them as far as being the Piranha Brothers. And Dinsdale Piranha thought he was being stalked by a imaginary hedgehog named he was being stalked by a hedgehog or something like that. It was because he was you know, he was mental. So look that up. That's pretty funny, actually.
I don't think I'd have been making fun of those guys when they were I mean, some of the ways these guys were, like, the one guy, one of the guys said something about the brother's wife or something. So he stuck a machete in the guy's mouth and ripped his mouth like on both sides, like Joker style. I was like, whoa.
Yeah, they kind of made that joke in Monty Python, only he nailed his head to a coffee table.
Yeah. Ooh. Yeah. And it wouldn't shock. I mean, it's these guys were vicious, man. I just like, wow. You know, well, what's going on outside of this stuff, Scott? What are you working on?
Well, real quick, too, speaking of pop culture, sure. You know, this year or this fall, it was the 30th anniversary of Goodfellas and 25th anniversary of Casino.
Casino, right.
Actually, the Mod Museum just had a big casino event the other night over there.
Did they have to wear masks?
Yeah. If you can go into a Mod Museum, you don't want anyone seeing your identity. Anyway.
That's right. Of course. Did you attend any of these events at all?
No.
Oh, hell no.
Down here in Florida. but I am doing an event with the Mod Museum on December 8th. We're doing a, you know, I do the Tampa Mafia tours, which is a walking tour of Ybor City in Tampa. And I'll get you guys the information offline. They're going to be doing a live stream.
Okay.
So I'm going to be, somebody's going to be filming me. I'm going to be doing part of my tour in Ybor City. At the same time, they're going to have people there in Vegas watching it. So kind of a real-time tour of the historic Ybor City where a lot of Tampa Wise guys met their end.
Right.
And then I'm working on my next book. It's going to be, I'll have it done probably in the spring.
Okay.
It's on the Purple Gang, which is this, I came across, I'm doing research on the Jersey Mob, and it's this group of drug dealing hitmen in the 70s and early 80s in New York City. And they were kind of like the outcasts of the mob. They're probably most associated with the Genovese family, but you know, they were responsible for a lot of murders and there were a lot of other murders attributed to them. So there was this kind of this myth evolved around them. So anytime a wise guy got hit, it was the Purple Gang. So I kind of wanted to really dig into them. And I've always wanted to do a book about like 70s era gritty New York City. So
sure.
So it's a good marriage of the two.
At some point, do you think you'll do, and I know this is Homer me, but do you think that you'll ever write something on like the Cleveland mob?
You know, Rick Perello, who did, he did To Kill the Irishman, and right. He just did a book recently on the that Jewish gangster. Oh, his name's escaping me, but he was in To Kill the Irishman. Oh, Shonder Burns.
Okay.
He's done a lot of really good stuff on Cleveland, and so is another author, Alan May, who really, they do Cleveland and Youngstown is kind of like their, you know, their territory as mob. As mob writers, we kind of stake out our territories.
Just like the mob, right?
Exactly. You know, there's George Anastasia has Philly. There's, a, you know, New York's a little open because it's so big, but some people have their little fiefdoms.
Nice. Well, I would think that there would be a treasure trove of, you know, things to write about just between Pittsburgh, Youngstown, and Cleveland. I mean, you know, just along those three cities, you know, steel producing cities, you would think that there would be plenty of, you know, history there and things to write about. Is that something of interest to you, or are you just more or less interested in the, you know, the New York factions or the Philadelphia factions?
I actually really like some of the smaller families, and I think there are a few that there's never been books written about. I think there's only been one book really about, in fact, I know there's only been one book about the Milwaukee Mafia. You know, there's a mafia family in Dallas. There's never really been anything written about that. Little kind of touches here and there on other books. Pittsburgh, there's only one book I know of that's really concentrates on Pittsburgh. It was a book, Mob Nemesis, by an old FBI agent who investigated the mob in Pittsburgh. So some of those smaller families, I'm really interested in, and you know, always looking around for what I might want to write in the future. So you want to look at some of those areas that are a little bit more underserved by what's out there book wise.
Sure. Well, go ahead.
Well, last week Chris and I were talking about the new documentary that was released on Amazon called The Grassy Knoll. You know, it uses a lot of the footage that you've probably seen on other documentaries and so on and so forth, but it kind of weaves it all together to give the underling James Files some credibility as being the Grassy Knoll shooter, mm-hmm. to where he's claimed he was all the way back in the 90s and the early part of the 2000s. And, you know, the way that he told his story and how he was involved, you know, he sounds very convincing. You know, there have been people who say, oh, well, he's just full of shit. He's just trying to get some notoriety and so on and so forth. But this guy rattles off a lot of facts and dates and times and who was there and who was involved and so on and so forth. But this new documentary kind of lends credibility to what he's saying as being true. Have you seen that? And what are your thoughts if you have?
I have not seen it yet, but it's on my queue list because I, you know, I love that stuff like you guys.
Sure.
Yeah, I remember reading stuff about Files back in the day. And, you know, I think it's good to have kind of a fresh perspective on some of that. So I'm definitely looking forward to it. And obviously, you know, my interest with the Kennedy assassination, not just the Traficante part, but again, you talk about a small Dallas family, you know, there was, you know, supposed involvement by Joe Civello, who was the boss of the Dallas Mafia. You know, you had Jack Ruby, who was friends with Joe Campisi, who was a Dallas mob guy. And a lot of people suggest that the reason Ruby was able to get into the police station was through, you know, not only knowing the cops, but some of the mob influence in the police department at the time.
Right. No doubt. Yeah. Scott, what happens to these guys when their families disband or dry up or whatever, you know? And specifically, you know, I want to go back to like what we were talking about with the Cleveland Youngstown. You know, I mean, when I was growing up, the Cleveland mob was a big deal. Like, yeah. You know, and I know I've told you that story before about my dad used to joke about his car getting blown up because that was legitimate in the, you know, in the 70s and 70s Cleveland.
Yeah.
But obviously the steel mills go away, and with that goes, I don't know if it's the power base or the influence or what have you, and they disappear. I mean, where do these guys end up going? Do they go and join up with mobs in other cities, or do they just get regular jobs or disappear, or what happens to them?
Yeah, I think in some of those smaller cities, that's exactly what happened. In fact, there was a bust in Pittsburgh not too long ago. It was a gambling bust, and there was a couple like sons of like some old time mob guys. I forget the name of the gentleman offhand, but a lot of them just kind of, you know, get regular jobs, maybe still kind of maintain a little bit of a life of crime. Rochester's another city that used to have a big mafia presence. Then they all went to jail, but then a lot of them got out and, you know, they just kind of faded away through attrition. Wow. Kansas City is another area like that where the family, you know, law enforcement took care of part of it and then the rest just kind of faded away, or they went into legitimate businesses or reinvested their money. You know, there's a few ways. A lot of them end up on social media. That's mostly guys that are testified end up on social media.
Right.
Well, that's a good point there, Scott. And it's always made me interested in that. Now, I've been to Kansas City. I used to drive a truck back in the 90s, and I used to go through Kansas City. And it's like the last city before a great expanse between that and, say, Denver. Mm-hmm. You know, there's like nothing. And it's just like, what is it about Kansas City that made that a hub for mob activity? I mean, it's kind of like out in the middle of nowhere. You know, it's like the end of Eastern civilization before you get to the West Coast. So what was it about Kansas City that made that a place for mob activity?
Well, there was a Sicilian community there. It was one of the earlier ones. And with the Sicilian migration, one of the things that we're finding out probably in the last few years, especially with the rise of genealogical research, is that there were like mob influences in all these cities much earlier than we initially thought. And they were working together. And Kansas City was one of those ones that just had an early Sicilian community, and there were mafioso that came over from Sicily there. Birmingham, Alabama was another one that had a small mafia family in the early years that kind of disbanded by the 30s. But most of them are driven by whatever industry is predominant in the area. So, you know, whether it's the coal mines of Northeast Pennsylvania or the steel mills, you know, out in the upper Midwest, Kansas City was, you know, was a pretty big metropolis back then. Like you said, you know, one of the only major cities till you get, you know, further out west. So because you had that Sicilian community there, it grew up, you know, a small mafia family. And you know, the thing that, you know, they, you know, I think Prohibition, certainly being on the river, helped them with becoming a power. But, you know, the thing about Kansas City, too, by the 1950s is they started investing in Las Vegas. And that really kind of gave them a big shot in the arm in terms of power. So they went from this kind of, you know, smaller mafia family. There were really close ties, too, between Kansas City and Tampa. And they had a large narcotics operation. The Antinori's in Tampa and a few guys in Kansas City were running heroin and morphine and probably a little bit of cocaine that was coming up through Cuba, through Tampa, and they were bringing up through Kansas City. So
from Kansas City, where did it go from there?
Some of it stayed local. Some of it ended up in Chicago. There was a pipeline that went up to Chicago.
Mm. Okay. So it would go from Florida out to Kansas City and then back to Chicago?
Some of it did. A lot of it stayed out in Kansas City. Some of it went to St. Louis. There were some indications that there were ties with the mafioso in St. Louis.
All right. Well, it just seems like an oddball place to have mob activity. Obviously, it was featured in a casino that they would meet in Kansas City to get, you know, to divide up the skim.
Yeah.
You know, but it's just like, why Kansas City? That's kind of like an oddball place. I mean, what was the main, you know, interest or industry or, you know, where was the revenue or the source of income for a mob, you know, faction to be involved in Kansas City?
It's barbecue.
Is that what it is? They were smuggling barbecue.
There's good eats. That's all it was. It was just good eats.
Well, it's the same thing like San Jose had a small mafia family. Like who? San Jose? Why? You know, it just sometimes where these groups ended up.
Was it the Dirty Sanchez mob or what?
No, the interesting side note about San Jose is the boss, Joe Cerrito, Life magazine called him a mafia boss in the 60s and actually sued him for libel and he lost. But he was the only mob boss that ever sued a magazine for calling him a mob boss.
Wow. Funny.
Very cool. All right. Well, Scott, is there anything else going on in the mob world that we're not aware of or that isn't making news that you got a little insight on that you can, you know, share with us?
Yeah, I'll tell you, because I know how much you guys absolutely love social media. So I'll tell you a funny story that happened. So, you know, I'm doing this book on the Purple Gang, and there's two mob guys. One I know pretty well, John Alight. He was on that Fear City documentary on Netflix. And this other guy, Gene Borello, and they have this show on YouTube. It's an interview show. It's a podcast, and they interview ex-mob guys. So they had a guy on there, John Rubio, who was a Genovese guy who became an FBI informant and ended up testified at Merlino's trial. And he went on their show talking about it, and he made some admissions on the show that called into question his testimony. So I was in contact with him to talk with him, to interview him for my book. And he's like, well, you have to talk to my attorney and we'll get it set up. And he was on Instagram. We were talking and then like radio silence. And it turns out because he went on John and Gene's show and started talking about his testimony and bringing into question some things that he talked about on the stand. Long story short, he's up in front of a federal judge right now. He might have to go back to prison. He might have violated his probation and the agreement he had with the FBI because he went on YouTube. So yeah, that's a good show. I would recommend you guys watch it. John and Gene show on YouTube because they have some good conversations with some ex-wives guys on there.
Wasn't that other guy I can't think of his name, but he does really good long interviews with mob guys. He's like an Indian guy.
Oh yeah, I know.
I can't ben think of David his name.
Patrick Dippin. Yeah.
I know I'm doing a great job selling him. Oh, there's this guy, he's Indian and I don't know his name, but he's great.
Yeah, but no, he does good. And there's another one, Vlad TV, that he does good.
Yeah, I've watched some Vlad TV. He does really good stuff too.
Yeah,
Yeah, good stuff. Well, dude, at some point you got to get us. You got to get us lined up with a mob guy, so we can actually have a mob guy on the show. That would be the best.
I will reach out and make a few calls.
All right, please do. That would be awesome. That'll make doing this dumb show worthwhile, man. To actually, the closest.
You guys have been great to me, so I'll do what I can to.
That'd be great for you. The closest we've come, I think, so far was Freeway Rick Ross, and that's like in my world, that's like the greatest interview I've ever been involved with.
Wow. That's awesome.
Because and it was so easy. That was the part that, and you could probably attest to this too. A lot of times you just send them an email and they hit you back.
Oh yeah.
And, I hit Rick Ross, Freeway Rick Ross. I found an email on his website and I didn't know. I just threw him an email and he hits me back. It goes, give me your phone number. I'm going to send you a text. And I said, okay. And he texted me like 2 minutes after I sent him my phone number. And he's like, okay, now I know where you are. I'll come on and interview with you. And I was like, okay.
That's great.
and that guy's been involved in a little bit of stuff.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
All right, man. Well, very cool.
All right, Scott. Well, why don't you throw out your plugs there where people can find you, where people can find your books and all that kind of good stuff.
Sure. ScottDeitche.com, ScottDeitche.com, or TampaMafia.com. You can get to me through that as well.
All right.
My books available on Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble and all over the place.
Perfect. Cool.
And if I could throw in a plug, The Silent Don, awesome read.
Thank you.
I definitely recommend that one to everybody. It's one of the, I think now I'm up to 5 books as an adult that I've read, and that would be one of them. So,
well, I appreciate being in that esteemed, grouping of.
Well, it's not that esteemed. 2 of them are Howard Stern books. So. Good book.
All right, Scott. Well, you're welcome on anytime. Glad you're a fan and you enjoy the show. So since you mentioned the new Armored Saint or asked about it at the beginning of the interview here, I'm going to play a song from the brand new Armored Saint. And I think this kind of fits the situation. This one is called My Jurisdiction.
There you go.
Nice. All right. Thanks, guys.
All right. Well, this is for Scott. Brand new Armored Saint exclusively here
on your classic metal show.
This is Jeff.